Welcome to the Washington AI Network podcast. I'm Tammy Haddad, founder of the Washington AI Network, where we bring together official Washington, D.C. insiders and AI experts who are challenging, debating, and just trying to figure out the rules of the road for artificial intelligence. This special episode features a keynote interview with Elham Tabbasi, Chief AI Advisor at NIST and Chief Technology Officer for the new U.S. AI Safety Institute. The conversation you're about to hear took place at the Special Competitive Studies Project's inaugural AI Expo for National Competitiveness on Tuesday, May 7th in Washington, D.C. Join us as Elham Tabbasi brings us up to date on the U.S. government's AI efforts and answers audience questions. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for listening. Welcome, everyone, to the AI Expo for National Competitiveness. Let's thank Illy and all our friends at the Special Competitive Studies Project for putting this together. We're so glad you're here, and it's such an honor to talk to Elham Tabbasi, who you guys know is the Chief AI Advisor for NIST. It's the most powerful and transformative technology of our time. You played such a critical role for so many years. Welcome, welcome, welcome. And I'm going to start by taking you back to that day when ChatGPT came out. First of all, was that a surprise to you?
First, thank you very much for having me. Delighted to be here and great to see many friends in the audience. So ChatGPT, when it came out, a year before that, we had seen release of several similar softwares that can take, for example, the software such as DALL-E that can take prompts as text and generate images that very much look like the real world images. So we were kind of familiar with the technology, and about that time we are also working on finalizing the AI risk management framework. So we paid a lot of attention to where the technology is going, particularly with the eye towards making sure that the AI risk management framework can be as evergreen as possible, knowing that the technology is moving really fast. We know that it's not going to be, revision is going to be needed, but we didn't want to have a very short shelf life. So AI RMF came out in January. In November, ChatGPT-3 went out. In February, ChatGPT-4 came out and then basically took the oxygen of every conversations and every room. So what we did immediately after that, put a group of experts together, start reaching out to experts outside of NIST, interviewing people, asking the question that is the guidelines, AI RMF that we put out in January, is still relevant or immediate changes is needed. And what we heard from the community is that no, it is relevant, but we also need to learn risks that are unique to this technology, to large language models, to generative AI models, and think about kind of risk management for the risks that are unique to generative AI or uniquely exacerbated by generative AI. So we quickly put a public working group together to look at those type of risks. We were working with them over the summer until the executive order came out and basically give a more urgency and speed to the work that we were doing.
And how do you pick who's in that group, the working group, that researchers, private industry, government, who is that?
At NIST, we have a very talented pool of experts and scientists, and all of them with very much committed and with a love for public service. Shout out to public service. But we also know that we don't have all of the information, so we reach out to the broader community. For the public working group, we basically, it was open to any individuals that wanted to sign in and be part of this. Being part of the government, there are some sort of a kind of security that makes sure that certain individuals from certain countries are not part of the work. But our work is open, transparent, kind of reachable and accessible to the broader community for them to use. For that public working group, it was everyone, but that is also a hallmark of the way we do the work. We have a lot of really good experts, but we also know that we don't have all of the answers. So we reach out to the community through many formal mechanisms, such as requests for information. We run workshops, we go to the meetings. We try to get all of the inputs, and when we reach out to the community, we make sure that we reach out to the very broad and inclusive and diverse set of thoughts and backgrounds and expertise. Of course, we want to hear from technology developers. That's usually encompass expertise such as computer science, mathematicians, statisticians, engineers. but also the community that study the impact of technology. And that's the psychologists, sociologists, cognitive scientists, because AI systems are more than just data, compute, and algorithm, a complex interactions of data, compute, and algorithm with the environment, with the human. So it's important to have the socio-technical lens. So that's how we do it. And in our all of work, we make sure that we have all of this community involved, but also the experts in standard development so that we can give the right input to the research community, but also policymakers.
6 months ago, the president announced his executive order, which literally realigns government and people working in AI, basically saying everyone's got to have someone in AI. How has that changed what you're doing, and how do you support those efforts?
So executive order, as you said, is a very comprehensive set of instructions to federal government to be basically an example for advancing trustworthy and responsible use of AI. I'm told that this is the longest executive order in the history of executive orders, but definitely in terms of its breadth and depth and the number of the instructions and tasks to different agencies.
How many people know how long the executive order is? 111 pages, I think it is, right?
That's right. That's right. And on the Federal Register notice, by cutting out the margins and making the font smaller, they made it to 87 pages. But this, yes, the one that you look at it is that long. So we got several tasks as part of the executive order. And the tasks that we got really build on the foundational work that we had been doing on understanding trustworthy implementation and adoption of responsible AI, the work that we have been doing around AI risk management. And I like to say that those direct tasks and the timeline that we got through the EO really supercharged our effort to work with the community stronger and faster and better to release guidelines for test and evaluations, for secure software development, for synthetic content authentications, for global engagement in promoting technical standards. And I'm very pleased to say that last week, on Monday, April 29, we put four of the draft out for public comment. They are out for public comment till June 2nd. So to all of you that are already looking at it, thank you. For the rest of you, please check out our website. We really like to hear from you guys, and we are on track to deliver all of them by the deadline of the EO, which is end of July.
And what's the website? Anyone have done it yet, public comments? Okay, now's your chance. You're hearing it directly from Elham.
So send a note to me, but if you just go and Google NIST AI EO, it just takes you directly to the website that has all of the information. Thank you.
6 months have passed. Can you talk about how the technology itself has changed in that period of time?
Yeah. So the technology, you know, the pace of change and also adoption of this technology is nothing like we had seen before. The speed and scale of this technology is just one of the many challenges that we have. And this pace is, frankly, much faster than any evaluations, standard work, or even policy can keep up with that. So that all means that we have to work faster and work with the community harder. And also know that as all of these things changes, and that's really true for any scientific endeavor, we learn by doing. So let's just work together. Let's just figure out the challenges, come up with the solutions, and knowing that we need to iterate. We are not going to get the perfect answer. So we get some answers, we learn something, and let's build on that and do more.
It sounds like an exhaustive process. How do you keep it all organized? I mean, are you on, I don't know, Excel sheets, Google Docs?
Yeah.
You know, do you like 10 researchers say this, 5 say that? How does that work, and how is it collated?
All of the above and more.
Okay.
But I think a lot of us, you know, I think it's the sense of the mission, and a lot of us really believe in what we can do to help this particular sort of the crossroad of the technology, science, and policy. And really, many of us really feel a moral obligation to make sure that AI can be, the power of AI can be harnessed for good, while its negative consequences and harms can be minimized. So I think this compelling mission and the role that we are playing, but also seeing the impact of the work that we do. We put AI RMF out in January, and in weeks after that, we were hearing that people are implementing it and hearing good things about this. So these are all really strong reinforcement for us to keep going. And of course, the work of the whole community. So grateful for all that, all the support.
So managing the risks of AI What's the process for that? You guys really started it years ago when you put together the NIST framework. But where are you now on that?
Yeah, I want to say a few things before directly answer your question. So we often hear that risk or safety can be in contradiction with innovation. But really what we are doing and have been doing all along is figuring out how to manage the risk and negative consequences of AI systems to unlock innovation, to harness the power of AI for good. So really that's what we're doing. This is the journey we are. And if you look at the definition of risk in the AI RMF that, as you said, we did it years ago, the definition of risk is a composite measure of the probability of an event happening and the consequences of that event. The consequence of an event can be positive, negative, or neutral. That makes, as strange as it sounds, risk can be positive, negative, or neutral. All this means that risk management becomes about maximizing the positive while minimizing the negative consequences at the same time. So when you're doing the risk management, the risk of not using AI, the risk of not using technology become one of the risks that needs to be understood and managed. So I just want to mention that all of these things is really to unlock innovations, to bring the community to find, to work on the challenges. And our job is that through evaluations, through other work that we do, put some empirical knowledge and evidence on the limits and capabilities of the technology, quantify the risk and impacts that there are, so the community better know where to put their efforts on advancing research, advancing innovations, and tackling the challenges with risk management.
So you're saying that innovation actually helps you with risk management?
Risk management is really for innovation, yes. Yes, these are really, you know, the better we know the failures of the technology, that's where the more innovations can happen. And we had done it with other technologies before at NIST. If you look at, for example, on the evaluations that we have been running for biometrics and face recognition, the first series of the evaluations that we did, face recognition algorithms fail if the person was not looking directly into the camera. That problem is solved, of course, because of the technology improved. But quantifying the failure modes, quantifying the risks, quantifying what are the problems with the technology really gets the developers, scientists, researchers back on the drawing board, back on the whiteboards to come with better ideas and innovation.
Let's turn and talk about authentication. There's so many different points of view. Where are you coming from on these issues?
Yeah. Thank you. So this is important to say that at NIST, we don't have really preconceived answers. We do the science, we work with the community, and we let the empirical evidence and science leads us to the answers. So in this particular topic, which is a very important topic and a lot of really smart people are looking at that, we actually do have a task as part of the executive order that starts by just do a landscape survey of what are the techniques, measures, tools for synthetic content authentications. And as many of the reports and the work that we do at NIST, we like to actually start with terminology and taxonomy at a lower level because it's really important to bring the whole community on a shared understanding about the topics and the word that we use. It's often the case that we use the same term, meaning different things. So the report is out, you can go look at it. And we look at it and bring the community around the discussions about digital content transparency. So, you know, you all have heard watermark, you had seen those kind of draft that goes across the page. All of those things are examples of ways for the watermark work actually trying to say something about the documents and the content of that documents. So the report that you will see is just start talking about digital content problem, the digital content transparency, and in that context, talk about the role of the metadata tracking or provenance data tracking. That's really basically recording and tracking the origin and history of a piece of content. This by itself is not going to solve the problem of transparency, but that information is really important to basically give some information about where this piece of content came about, if it was human-generated, AI-generated, or manipulated by AI. And then there's also another track of synthetic content detection. So if there is a content, then an algorithm can look at it, or a human can look at it and make a judgment that it was generated by human or by algorithm.
Will there ever be a time that a regular person, not a scientist, will be able to look at something and know if it's synthetic or original content?
Yeah, that's a great question. And our hope is that provide that type of transparency to get there. Of course, there are several technical challenges to solve that. There's also a lot of questions around digital literacy and how to actually share that information, assuming that we have a technical solution to get to how to actually make sure that the content is human-generated or AI-generated or manipulated, but how to present that and how to communicate that with humans. So all of these things are on the table to discuss. And I stay hopeful that, yes, the science and the scientists and researchers and working with the whole community, we will get the solutions.
Do you think that AI will ever be in schools, that kids will learn from a young age what AI is, what's synthetic, what's real? Is there any sense of that now, or anyone who's working on it?
So I think my children are grown up, so I don't know, but I think people are using it and children are using it.
But I mean the education part.
You know, my take on any technology is that these are powerful tools, and by right safeguards and right use cases and right set of kind of how to use them, but also how to build them safe, yes. I always say this, that we want technologies that's easy to do the right thing, difficult to do the wrong thing, and easy to recover if somebody inadvertently did the wrong thing. Perfect example of that is the 3-pin plug, electricity plug that we had. It took some time with a lot of, you know, maybe even fire or something that we get there. But if we look at it this way, and for the AI also approach it this way, that instead of putting or thinking about the safeguards that we want to put after the technology has been developed around the use and through the policy and regulations try to fix them, yes, that's one way of doing this. But also let's think about how we can actually build a technology that all of these questions and challenges can be tackled as part of the design and development of that. So I stay hopeful that yes, AI would be as similar in everyday life as possible. And along the way, we have also solved many of those challenges, either through technical measures, socio-technical measures, better educations. And again, as I really want to say that we get AI to work for us and improve our lives.
I want to ask you about the NIST Gen AI Challenge.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, thank you. Thanks for asking that and giving me the opportunity to brag about this. So one of the things that we do at NIST is run evaluations to, again, get a sort of a sense of limits and capabilities of technology. And we have done it for many different type of technology. As part of these broader evaluations, another type of activities and efforts that we run is what we call challenge problems. And the goal of that is really to encourage and inspire researchers and technologies and engineers to come up with solutions. So the Gen AI challenge that was also announced last Monday has two tracks. One track invites submissions of algorithms that can generate synthetic content that can look very real. So the first track that we are doing is text-to-text. It gets a text and generates text, or it gets a series of documents and generates summarizations. And we're going to go and look at them and evaluate them to see how good the algorithm can generate those synthetic text.
Are these new companies or researchers or individuals? Or is this like OpenAI, NVIDIA, whatever?
Our test is open to everybody, and we're hoping to get a very broad participation. But the Gen AI has another track there too, and that's a discriminator that gets a piece of text and try to make a judgment that this was generated by human or algorithm. So by looking at both of them and getting the best outcomes from the generators to the discriminators, or applying the best discriminators on the results of the generators, we are trying to basically do a sort of a blue team, red team to improve both of those things. So participation is open to everybody. The only thing is that they had to be able to implement the API that we have. But if I can judge from the past evaluations that we run, industry participates, academia participates, small and medium-sized companies participate. And that's really our job, kind of convene the community around problems and challenges that relate to all of them and try to advance them.
Are you concerned about China or other bad actors participating in this program?
I do believe in open science, and I do believe in that knowledge is always really a great thing. So it's better for us to know what they're doing and what their capabilities are rather than us being in dark. But as I said, as part of the participations, the entities that sign up for our test, go through some vetting process, regular government vetting process. And if they are foreign nationals, they go to extra vetting process that's done by experts at NIST or outside of the NIST to make sure that national security is, the considerations is all preserved.
And how big is your team? This sounds like a heavy lift, don't you guys think? It sounds like a lot.
So our team is growing and we like to grow more. I always say that we are really limited by the number of the hours in a day and the number of the people that are working on this. And there's only one degree of freedom in that equation and the number of the people. But we also increase our capacities by working with the whole community. So when we put the document out for public comment and we hear from hundreds of entities and organizations outside, this is that really expanding our capacity. And recently also, many of you know that we established or stood up a consortium as part of the Safety Institute. And the number of the entities that are part of the consortium are around 270 and increasing. So that gives us another way of really working with.
Who were the 270?
Basically, I want to say almost any actors in the AI, all of the big names of the industry are there. We also have smaller businesses that are making tools or working in this area. We have universities, we have civil society, we have experts from the verticals, you know, healthcare, finance, all of them. The name of all of those are actually posted on our website. We really truly believe in being open and transparent, so everything is on our website.
Okay, we have a question.
You talked about putting a watermark on things that have been created, let's say, synthetically or in some way that they're not appearing, you know, naturally or genuinely. What happens in the case of the upcoming presidential election when we have foreign countries like Russia, for example, and others putting AI developed images and other things out there that contain misinformation and are misleading, and what can NIST do about it, and is that something you're working on?
Thank you for the question, and that's a really important topic. I want to say a few things first, that NIST is a non-regulatory agency, and our job is really work with the community to develop guidelines, run evaluations, advance measurement science and standards, measurement science and standards that make technology more reliable, more robust. We don't do any certifications, and again, we are not regulatory. So in the context of the synthetic content and digital content provenance, we're really working with the community to A, understand what's happening right now, what's the knowledge space looks like right now, and then after that, work with the community on developing possible guidelines for those reasons. So development of the guidelines is not something that we are currently doing, but your question is a lot broader than that. Your question gets into misinformation, disinformations, and distributions of those type of informations, which is several steps away from the work that we are doing. Those are really important conversations, but our work doesn't get into misinformation and disinformation. So as I said, for example, content provenance can give information, you know, provide in transparency about origin and history of a content, but by itself doesn't quite ensure or assure trustworthiness.
Where in the federal government would you say is focusing closely on the misinformation, disinformation issues that we're all going to be facing?
That's really CISA that's doing that. Jen Easterly and her team at CISA. Any other areas?
I would say that there is work across the government agencies that are working on this. It's definitely CISA is one of them. More on the operational side, CISA has the responsibility of basically looking after elections being fair and robust. But our job right now is more around, again, everything that we do is around technical guidance and socio-technical guidance, but we are several steps before.
Is there another question?
You mentioned that there are positive and negative risks. Are there one or two of each of those that you'd be able to share with us from kind of the scientific data perspective?
Yeah.
I mean, there's some obvious ones, content, but just from your perspective, are there one or two that you could share in each?
Thank you. So in the AI RMF, we actually come up with trustworthiness characteristics. So it's sort of the flip side of the risks, and it talks about the characteristics of the system that you want to see to make them trustworthy. So if I want to talk about risk, some of those things becomes, for example, harmful bias, that AI systems can exacerbate the inequities in the society and all of this. And if I want to say a positive risk of AI systems is broader access to, for example, a lot of resources. I also want to say that as part of the executive order tasking that we had, one of the documents, one of the four documents, talks about the 12 risks that are sort of unique or uniquely exacerbated by generative AI. So hallucinations, giving violent or toxic recommendations, all of those things are being listed as part of that. But other things are, for example, things such as data privacy, information security, information integrity. These are other risks.
Has there been any progress on hallucinations? I've read some recent stories in the last couple weeks that the hallucinations are in a decline. I mean, if that's something you can really address.
That's a good news if that's being declined. And I think that's what happens when we have more information about where the systems fails. And that's sort of positive feedback that I talked that developers use these things, go back to the drawing board. We haven't done the, at NIST we like to have real empirical data to talk about it, and we haven't done that test yet, but yeah.
Could I ask a follow-up to that?
Please, go ahead.
So from a generative AI perspective, part of the challenge is that federal agencies have very clearly legally reviewed content that is available on their websites, whereas a Gen AI may actually interpret that and then explain that in plain language to, or in a different language even. Is there any risk that you see or that you're tracking in that alteration of approved language?
If your question is about LLMs getting a text and then provide a summary of that, and if the summary is accurate, hopefully the Gen AI challenge is going to look at that. So stay in touch. Thank you.
Okay, one final question. What about the plan for global engagement? Because it's hard enough to get everyone in the United States to be on the same page on anything, let alone AI. So how are you working on the global engagement side?
Yeah, that's a great question, and thank you for that. So another task that we had as part of the EO was developing a global engagement for promotion of AI standards. AI standards is becoming more and more a topic of interest to, and I keep saying it, I go to the standard meeting since 2005 and everybody rolled their eyes because it can be a very boring topic, a lot of discussions, but it really warms my heart that now standard is a really important topic and some area on AI standard ecosystem is where that can really inform AI actors on how to enforce and implement a lot of regulations. So, for example, we have seen EU AI Act passing regulations or any of the other regulations. You know, they say at the text of the law stays as very abstract level of AI must be non-discriminatory, AI must be safe. They don't get into explaining or saying what they mean by non-discriminatory, what they mean by safe. Or even more importantly, how can we test and assure that it is safe or non-discriminatory? And in the absence of having an ecosystem of standards that address these questions and provide tools on how to look at these problems, these questions can be adjudicated in courts, and that's not the way we want it to go. So in the global plan for engagement in standards, we talk about activities before, during, and after standardizations with a lot of emphasis on AI is a global technology, data doesn't know border, technology doesn't know border, and we need to work with the partners around the world to advance one set of interoperable standards, one set of rule of the roads for AI safety that helps with more interoperability across the borders, that can improve trades, that can improve the science, and ultimately more economic growth and prosperity for everyone.
That is fantastic. Thank you, Elham. Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening. Okay, I want everyone in here to stand up. Elham, come on, we're going to stand up. And I want you guys to all, come on, stand up, get your phones up. Let's move. It's an AI expo. You have to move fast. Okay, and I want you to put your phones up and take a picture of Elhan. Come on.
Look.
Yeah. Just stay right there because she started off. Okay, and now take a picture, everyone together. 1, 2, 3. Okay, now everyone turn around and get yourself in the picture with Elhan so you can say you were at the AI Expo with the Chief Technology Officer of NIST. Thank you, Elhan, so much. Much appreciate your time.